That's how I got started. And then Jimmy LeFevre's father was the playground director at the playground. So for 50 cents, you get into a, he puts you on a team, and the first team I belonged to, I believe, was the Tigers. And it was all the kids on the, 20th Century Studio was about four blocks away, and all the little kids that were in the movies, that's where they had their breaks, where they'd come to the playground, and so we got to know all the little kids on the Our Gang series.
Wow.
And Buck Wheat was our right fielder. A kid by the name of Leonard Landy was in the series. He was our first baseman, and we still see each other. Not Buck Wheat. Buck Wheat's gone, but
Leonard.
Leonard Landy is still here.
How do you spell his last name?
L-A-N-D-Y.
Huh. Were there also adults affiliated with Hollywood who came around too?
Well,
to watch?
Well, the studio was close, and I imagine there was a lot of, what were those two brothers that played, they were very big on the playground. They were a kid that played in, he played the green hair kid, he played Leopold Loeb, he played in that. He was the lead, I can't think of his name right now. But anyway, we had a lot of kids that were movie stars, and they came out there and played with us, you know. That was the Little League. Then we played junior baseball there, and our high school was right next door, so we went to Dorsey High School, and it was a baseball mecca, really. The kids were mostly baseball players.
Mm-hmm. Major League Baseball was not there yet, right?
No, that was Pacific Coast League. It was called Pacific Coast League with an open classification, and that meant that teams like the Angels were owned by the Cubs, and the Hollywood Stars were owned by the Pittsburgh Pirates. And then you had a lot of independent teams like Oakland, who had their own. I played for the Oakland Oaks, the Pacific Coast League, and they had their own minor league system. Stockton was their minor league, and Sacramento was an independent. San Francisco was independent. It was more or less an open class, which meant they signed their own players, or they could, or other teams could lend them players, you know, the big leagues.
So
they made more money than the big leagues in the Pacific Coast League.
Right. So as a kid growing up in California, was your real interest more in the Pacific Coast League than Major League Baseball?
Oh, I didn't know anything about Major League Baseball. The only thing I knew was Pacific Coast League, and the reason I knew that, because we had two kids on the playground, Sparky Anderson and a kid by the name of Elmer Ammons, were the bat boy and the ball boy for the Hollywood Stars. And on the playground, we always had balls, and we always had crack bats that we'd nailed together, because the Sparky and Elmer Ammons were right there. They knew professional baseball players. They owned the first jock strap. They owned the first jock with a cup in it. They knew what baseball, real baseball gloves. four diamonds.
And drool. I guess they drooled.
They drooled. Oh, my God. And then they would cover just about every high school, good high school team in the city in a 3 or 4 day span. You see, every kid had to show up there. And that's what it, now they have the finals is at Dodger Stadium and they got fancy, you know. But that's the way that goes. But that's the way the baseball was. It was a baseball, it wasn't Little League. It wasn't organized like it is today. We played in Levi's. We slid in Levi's. The only time we got a uniform was when we went to American Legion Baseball. And that was big. American Legion, at that time, was a big, big issue, you know. And we won a national championship in 1951 from that playground.
Wow, what was the name of your team?
Crenshaw, Post 715.
And any name like a team name like Dodgers or Giants or something?
No, it was just you had that right across your chest was Post 715, and that was it. Crenshaw, Post 715. We left California and we went to Arizona. Went to Hastings, Nebraska, all by train, and we ended up in Detroit, Michigan, Briggs Stadium. We played White Plains, New York, Jacksonville, Florida, and Cincinnati. And
you beat them all.
We beat them all. We had Grover Jones, was the catcher for White Plains. He made the big leagues. We had Russ Nixon, the catcher for the Cleveland Indians and Boston Red Sox, the manager of Atlanta. He was the catcher for Cincinnati. We had... Of course, our team, we had seven of the kids eventually sign, professional contracts after college or whatever, Sparky and I went right from high school.
I guess you don't want to brag about yourself, but you must have been tremendously instrumental in winning that championship for your American Legion team.
Well, it was a funny thing. I was high school player of the year in baseball here in Los Angeles in 1951 and 1952. And then I was athlete of the year in... What year would that have been? I was athlete of the year twice also. I ran track. I was a track man and a basketball and baseball. And then, I was a 10 flat 100 man. I was a third, I'd get you a point in the high school 100. I ran the 220 and I ran the first man on the relay because I never worked out with the track team because our baseball schedule was Tuesdays and Thursdays and our track meets were on Fridays and I never worked out with the team. So they said, you lead it off and you hand the baton. And that's how that went, But the scouts all told me as a youngster, don't play football because if you get hurt, then we couldn't swim, we couldn't lift weights. Those were the things they did in those days, And God knows they never look at a ball player that wore glasses, so I think we played it. If you wore glasses in those days, a scout would never even look at you. And
you needed them?
No, I never needed them. I imagined a lot of kids that we played with.
Yeah.
If they saw a scout in the stands, they were hiding their glasses. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In those days, it was a tough. It was nice to, the scouts were interested, and in those days there was no draft.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, a scout like Lefty Phillips was probably instrumental for Sparky in just about anything in baseball, because in that area, Lefty.
He was the Dodger scout, right?
Yes, sir. He was a Dodger scout, and he also ran the Dodger Juniors, which I played for about 5 years. He started that league and semi-pro. He had Drysdale. He had all the kids he signed with. That he signed the Sherry brothers. They all were Lefty Phillips. And he signed most of the kids from that playground and every playground. Lefty was. Good man. He brought the baseballs and bats, and then of course he ran the Dodger Juniors, and they gave him uniforms. And
this is before they came out to California, though, right?
This is the,
or after.
This is they had played at the Coliseum at the time. This is before. It would be before the new stadium.
Right.
It would be.
But it was when they were out in California already.
Right. Yeah. That's right. Because before, the Dodgers would have a winter. Camp at the stadium, and the kids would work out before they all flew to Florida, that sign with the Dodgers. So that was a nice thing, too. That's where you got to meet all the kids,
But in your growing up years, so you were really one of the most phenomenal players to come out of California. Was there another player that you came into contact with in your growing up years
Sox. They were both outstanding players. And yeah, I would say Floyd, I think it was, I don't know what his first name is, but his name was Pinfold, a great pitcher out of high school. And he went to the White Sox organization, mm-hmm. as far as I know.
Right.
And then I saw Grover Jones in our final series in Michigan. He hit one on an upper deck. Good left-handed hitter for White Plains, catcher. And he hit that upper deck in Detroit, and I mean a bullet. So I always remember those type of players, you know.
But was the style of play integrated in your growing up years, or was it all white?
Say you went to Dorsey High School, they had zones. If you lived in the zone, you could go to Dorsey.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up with...
integrated.
Not integrated, because in high school, we had... I ran track with the blacks. I played basketball with the blacks. And high school baseball, if we had to go travel somewhere to Jefferson or Jordan or things like... I'm trying to think of the kid I played with. Earl Batty.
Right.
Earl Batty, yes. Catcher for Washington Senators and Minnesota Twins.
Right.
He was a great athlete, a great basketball player, and I played against him in baseball, so who else? The kid that played, he went to, what do you call it? I'm trying to think of the kid's name. He played basketball. Earl Knowles. What's the basketball player for the New York?
He played
center for the UCLA Bruins. Earl, what's his name? God.
Bibby?
Knowles?
Bibby?
Not Bibby. Jeez, this guy was a pitcher for... and then he went to high school. He went to UCLA, was the center for UCLA before Walton and before Jabbar. And Willie Knowles.
Oh, Willie Knowles,
Willie
right.
Knowles.
Right, Willie Knowles, yeah.
And he went to San Pedro High School, and he went right to the Knicks, I believe.
Yeah.
Great athlete also.
You were mentioning equipment that you played in. You said you played in Levi's, et cetera. Do you remember any of the gloves that you used? What model they might have been or order?
Yeah. I used a Bobby Dellinger infield glove for second base, and I used a Mort Cooper infield and pitcher's glove for shortstop. Mort Cooper was just a little longer fingers.
Mm-hmm.
And that was through my whole career as a major league player.
And how about how about when you were a kid, though?
When I was a kid,
yeah.
I used a Rawlings, and it was a Bobby Dellinger. That's all I knew the name. It was a little infield glove with short fingers, and that's the way they had them in those days. The bigger gloves were outfield gloves. And
how about a bat? Any memory of a bat that you used?
I think on the playground, we used mostly all-city. Player, and we played against major league players in the offseason here in Los Angeles. That That's before Major League Baseball was out here.
Mm-hmm.
And,
any players that stand out that you played against?
Oh, God. Well, the Roosevelt Plumbers were a team that most of the kids from FC used to play for. And Jimmy Breedweiser, Art Masmanian, Hank Workman, catcher was Zuber. These kids all signed with the New York Yankees in those days. All the kids from FC all signed with the Yankees. When the Dodgers came out here, Rod Dedeaux, of course, had played for the Dodgers, and most of the kids came out of FC went with the Dodgers. So it was FC was the big school out here for baseball. Rod Dedeaux,
mm-hmm.
which we knew, because if you played baseball, you had to play against the Trojans somewhere along the line, and there was Rod Dedeaux, you know.
Right, and Sparky was the bat boy.
And Sparky was the bat boy because George lived right down the street from Boulevard. A lot of great players come out of FC in those days.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. They had, and I played against a few of them when I was at the Red Sox. The people that played at FC. But it was a baseball mecca, too, there.
Your actual signing to by the Red Sox, how did that come to be? Do you remember the circumstances?
Yeah, Joe Stevenson was my scout that scouted for the Red Sox.
Right. That's S-T-E-V-E-N.
He was a ball player in a giant organization, and he's just started scouting, I think, at that time. A big scout out here for the Red Sox was a man named McDowney. Something Downey. And he signed Marty Keel. Marty Keel was the greatest athlete coming out of CIF, football and baseball. And I think Marty got just about as much money as anybody that ever signed in baseball. No bonus rule at that time, 1952, when Marty Keel graduated. I graduated in 1953, January of 53. December of 53, the baseball meetings, they put in a rule in baseball. They said, if any kid gets over $4,000, he goes right to the big leagues as one of the 25 players. He is on the roster for 2 years. That was the penalty for signing the kid. In the one. And I happen to be the first kid that had that bonus rule affected.
Really?
I signed with Joe Stevenson. Instead of having 16, there were 16 teams in the big leagues in those days. Instead of having 16 teams bidding for me after I graduated from high school, there was, I think it was 8. Because 8 teams couldn't carry an 18-year-old kid with no experience. The Red Sox, they were going through a youth movement and they signed me. So I went from high school, from high school. And
right to Fenway.
No, I went right to Sarasota, Florida, and the Red Sox were in spring training, and I walked right on the field, and the first man I played catch with was Dominic DiMaggio.
Wow.
I don't know why, but I ran out in the field. I didn't know a soul. The scout that signed me brought me there. Nobody knew him because he had just got the job, and he introduced himself, and then...
But Ted Williams was there then, right?
Ted Williams was there, and...
In fact, I'm going to try to reach him today. You don't still have any contact with him, do you?
Sparky and I used to see him every... when we were at Lakeland, Florida, we used to go down and see Ted when he was with the Red Sox as
mm-hmm.
an instructor.
Yeah, I'm wondering if he'll agree to an interview, but all I can do is try.
Well, yeah, you just tell him you spoke to Sparky Henderson and Bill Consolo. He'll remember me.
Okay, good.
But anyway, that's the way it went, and there is a bonus rule probably was the...
That's really interesting.
It helped Al Kaline. Kaline, I signed in that year of 53, Al Kaline signed in June.
Mm-hmm.
And Al Kaline, they just stuck him right in right field. And that was a blessing. You know, you do it or you don't. You know what I mean?
Right.
With me, it was an infielder, and Joe Cronin was our general manager, and he told me, he says, Billy, it's going to take you a lot longer being an infielder to be a major league player than any other position except the catcher.
Mm-hmm.
He says, a catcher, he says, is because they got to learn you got to learn the game. He says, and that's going to take you a little longer. So I don't want you getting excited when you see young kids coming up playing outfield. But Kaline was an outstanding player. He was, he played the outfield like an infielder,
yeah.
You know. And then he hit, and he could run, he could throw. So those things, it helped a lot of people, but probably there's more people that hurt, that both. was with the Red Sox. We went down to Miami, Florida to play the Dodgers. And they had this big kid in the bullpen, weighed 235 pounds. The Koufax you see now ain't even close to what the people saw when he first signed. He was a big kid. And he threw that ball 100 miles an hour. And so I met Sandy Koufax in 54, when he was popping up for the, for the Dodgers.
Sucks.
not going to sit there and with a bonus kid just sitting there for 7 years. They must have been trying to get rid of me.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to play me. I mean, Goodman was a great player, and he was
a natural hitter.
And yeah, I did. And the Red Sox bought Teddy Joost to play shortstop. They bought, Frank Malzahn came up out of the minors, and he was a great third baseman, you know. There was just no room. And of course, then the manager was a different story. That I could tell you a story about that guy that would turn your hair, whatever your color hair is, you'd go bald-headed if I told you what this man was like. But I ain't going
to
mention
that. No, because that has nothing to do with the growing up stories.
No,
that goes beyond that.
It
doesn't matter, though.
That guy took the youth, whatever they call them in those days. But that's the way those things are, you know. So anybody that...
John McGraw was the manager.
still could hit and he still could play ball.
He was great.
Those days, when you were 31, 32, or 33, you were considered washed up. Cut me tomorrow. might as well cut me then, because I'd have a ride home. So he insisted that I stick around, and he wanted to look at me a little longer, so they put me up in a hotel. And I took my friend with me to the hotel and let him sleep. And I think we only had one bed, so he slept on the floor. But I was told I could sign for meals, so we both had a big steak, and I signed for it. I'm sure they probably thought I was a real big eater. I bought a breakfast, and then he went on his way, and then I proceeded to stick around for the next few days. They took good care of me, and I saw that I was fed and had a place to sleep and all in the hotel. And the scout said that to go on home, that he'd have a job for me in 2 or 3 days. There were 3 of us that were surviving.
Highway. You know, there wasn't freeway.
Copy. I'm going there, too. And at that time, the New York World's Fair was on.
Oh, 39. 40, yeah.
40.
Yeah.
And it was, he took me right into New York City. But on the way, we stopped, and he bought me a nice dinner. Gave me a dinner. You know, I didn't have to pay for it. He wanted to pay for it. We were talking all the way. And he asked me where I was from, and I told him where I'd been. I wouldn't even remember his name today, but he seemed very nice. And dropped me off right at the subway station in the city. Because he was bringing some stuff to the World's Fair.
Wow.
And so I got on the subway. Now, mind you, I had 50 cents. Right? And so, anyway, it was a nickel for the subway, a nickel for the ferry boat, and a nickel for the bus. The bus left me off right by my house, about half a block from my house.
What street did you live on?
On Clove Road. And the bus driver dropped me right off at Castleton Avenue, Clove Road.
Yeah, I know where that area is.
Are you from there?
No, but a friend of mine lives on Pilcher Street.
On what street?
Pilcher.
Oh.
Near Willowbrook used to be there.
Yeah, well, that's over the other,
yeah.
The other side.
The other side. But I know a little bit about that.
I got off right at the corner and just had to walk three houses down, and there I was home. I got home with 35 cents.
Wow.
I'll always remember that.
And when did you leave? For Hamilton.
Three days later, my brother got a telegram. I had a job with the NYA, the National Youth Administration, which I had to work 7 days a month, and so it was my turn to go back to report to work and get my time in so I could earn a few dollars, you know, to give us, I think, $15 or $12 a month. There was no work in those days. This is, still a depression going. Kids got out of high school, there were no jobs. And so the city, I guess, or the national, they called it the National Youth Administration.
Right, I think it was through Roosevelt.
That's right.
Yeah.
It was a federal
program
to help keep kids going, keep them from getting them off the streets, give them something to do, And so,
what kind of work did you actually do?
Well, I was assigned to help in the blacksmith. Parks and Recreation. See, I worked up there at Clove Lakes Park. You remember?
Sure, I know that, yeah.
And
it's still there.
What's that?
It's still there.
Yeah. It's a beautiful place.
It is.
So the blacksmith's name was Joe Whitehouse. And I was assigned there, and I liked that in the morning. I'd get up and light the forge for him, and put in the coke, and I was learning a little bit about when it's going to happen.
Jackie Robinson incident.
That's right.
is. What did you start with the card?
What happened
yeah.
there? 1942. All of a sudden, the draft age was lowered from 21 to 18, and all of us that were had to register. We registered in that town of Asheville, Buncombe,
South Carolina, right?
North Carolina.
North Carolina. Yeah.
Well, they were a small town, and they were cleaned out of 21-year-olds. So all of a sudden, they were taking 18-year-olds, and half our ball club was drafted. And Dick Sisler was my teammate there. He decided to join the Navy. He volunteered as soon as he got his notice. Roland LeBlanc, who just passed away, and so did Sisler pass away. These guys all asked me about go with them, and I said, no, I think I'm going to go down to the draft board and see if I can't finish out the season. It's only a few weeks to go, and that's what I did. I was able to finish out the season, and the other buddy I had on the club, I came across his grave on Okinawa, Frank Zara. He was the catcher on our team.
Wow.
So we all got our draft notices at the same time.
How do you spell Frank's last name?
Z-E-R-A.
Wow.
He was a Polish kid from St. Louis, Missouri.
So you went into the Army that fall, after the
yeah.
season.
They gave me the extension to finish out the season, but I had to immediately report to Camp Upton. They know, well, the Army got a hold of me right away as soon as I got home.
How long were you in the service?
I was in the service 3.5 years.
And then you came out and you were still Cardinal property, or?
Yeah, I was still Cardinal property. I come out and I played at Lynchburg in 1946. I had to start all over again.
Did you? What did you do during the war? Did you play ball then?
Yeah, I played. I played on a base at Drew Field, Florida. Baseball kept me around in the States for a couple of years because I was playing for the base team. We played. We went on tournaments and everything.
That was good for the morale.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's what the.
And how did you wind up on Okinawa?
Well, what happened was that the Battle of the Bulge was taking place, so they started to put all the military. They started where they felt they had a surplus. They started putting everybody in the infantry, and so anyway, I was able to still stay in my Air Corps job. But I had to go overseas, and I didn't care where I went. So I went to, they shipped me to Fresno, California as a replacement. And from there, I went from Fresno to Dalhart, Texas, to an outfit that was getting ready to go overseas, and which we did. We were in Dalhart, Texas. We were in the Air Saber Service Group. And I was there for a couple of weeks, and then we were on a troop train headed for Seattle, Washington. I went to Hiroshima and Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
Right into it.
Go ahead. Not into combat, though. Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I almost got killed during an air raid on Hiroshima. That's the same island that Ernie Pyle got killed on.
Uh-huh.
He had been killed about 3 weeks before. See, when we got to Hiroshima, that island was, they had captured the island, so we were using it to fly our fighters off. And the fighting was still going on Okinawa.
How do you spell? Can you spell?
Throw away.
Hiroshima?
Yeah.
Can you spell it?
I-E. And then it's Hiroshima, which means island in Japanese.
S-H-E-M-A?
S-H-I-M-A.
I-E-S-H-I-M-A.
Yeah.
Hiroshima. Okay.
And when you could almost throw a stone or baseball, that's how close the island, on the island was to Okinawa.
You mentioned you came across the grave of the catcher?
Yeah, after the war.
How did that happen?
After the war, I had heard he'd gotten killed. It's amazing, rumors go around. Like when I got hurt during the air raid, two of my friends from my hometown, who I never saw before, came up to the field hospital to see me. And I said, how'd you guys know? I was in the word gets around when you, isn't that something?
Huh.
And they were from, one kid lived down the street from me.
In Staten Island?
Yeah.
Huh. Wow.
And both of them were from Staten Island.
So how about the grave, though, of the catcher?
Well, when the war was over, I'd heard he'd been killed. I just went through the cemetery there where General Buckner is, and all, they kept it nice, and I just made a visit. Just, you know, we had to wait. We were waiting our turn to come back home, and I just went through the cemetery there, and I found his grave.
How did that make you feel?
Well, he was my friend. I felt bad, you know. And, of course, I felt lucky that I was alive, because while I, what happened to me was I was trying to get off the boat that I was on, because we had to air raid. It was during the middle of the night, or the middle of the morning. You know, and you know that you want to get off the ship. We were unloading belly tanks for our fighters, and I wanted to get off and get on land. Well, I didn't realize that during the night, a few of the belly tanks had been moved, and I lost my footing trying to get off, and I went down to the bottom of the boat. And I'm lucky I didn't get killed, because I broke my fall. I probably dropped about 20, 25 feet. I never put in for the Purple Heart, because I felt that, how am I going to explain that?
So when the war ended, you went to Lynchburg, and then you moved your way up the rungs into the majors. So how many years did you get in the majors?
Well, I was just there that briefly, just a...
Just a cup of coffee?
Huh?
Just a cup of coffee.
Yeah, I got into three ball games.
To the Senators?
Yeah, I think what happened to me...
So your whole major league career basically was three games?
Yeah. What happened to me was I think I was spoiled by playing in the Pacific Coast League. And when I got to the major league, Bucky Harris was the man who drafted me, and he was the manager at San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he liked the way I played. And when I came to spring training, I was taken in to be his utility infielder. And I don't know. Partially it was my own doing. I think that I was spoiled from playing in a Coast League and on a championship ball club.
Well, the Coast League took place before the Senators.
Yeah.
So you went from Lynchburg?
I went from Lynchburg.
Into the Coast League?
No. I went to play for Omaha.
Right. And then?
In the Western League. Now, right. It was considered, then it was Class A. It would be like Double A or Triple A today. You know?
Uh-huh.
But,
Then you got to the Pacific Coast League.
Yeah. No, then I was sold to Denver. Denver became an independent club,
uh-huh,
in the Western League.
Right.
Along with Omaha.
Right.
Now, I was in the Cardinal organization. And, so Denver was turning independent, and I was the first ball player they bought, and they had been a Yankee farm. And Danny Menendez was the general manager of the Denver Ball Club, a general manager, part owner, along with Bob Housen, the Housen family.
Right.
And they were, and I was playing winter ball in Panama when Danny Menendez called me and told me he had bought my contract. He always liked the way I played, and he told me that he felt that I had a chance to go somewhere, and if I had a good season, then probably I would be sold to Hollywood or a major league club. And so I had a real fine year for Denver. I had hit 313, I had a good year, made the All-Star team.
What year was this?
1948.
Right.
And
then you got sold then to
Hollywood. My contract up,
uh-huh,
and I reported to Hollywood.
How many years did you play in the TCL?
Well, I played the first season, full season was 1949.
Right, Hollywood.
Yeah, and I was on a championship club.
Did you play in shorts?
Short, yeah. Oh, yeah. We played in shorts. That was, we used to do that on a Sunday. I think that was in 51 that they decided to use the shorts as an attraction. Not the first year, in 49. But anyway, at the end of the 49 season, I was drafted by the Washington Senators.
Right.
And I reported to spring training with Washington. And I was ticketed to be the utility infielder for Bucky. He had told me. But I got impatient. And one day, we were Fenway Park, and I told him I was not Yeah. And
that was it.
What's that?
That was one of the briefest careers ever.
Well, it was partially of my own doing.
Right. It was.
Yeah.
But at least you did play in the majors.
Yeah.
So that was interesting.
Right. What I'm trying to say is that it was difficult in those days. And then, of course, you know, losing 3.5 years of
right.
During the war. And then I think playing on an, you have no idea how nice the Pacific Coast League was. The conditions were better than the major leagues.
Right, yeah, I heard that. Yeah.
We used to play a week in each town.
Mm-hmm.
You'd fly into Seattle or fly into Portland. You're there for a whole week. You play, and then every Monday was off.
That was it.
Play a doubleheader on Sunday, and you would play 2 weeks on the road. Well, then when I went to spring training in Washington, everything was a bust, and it was just a complete letdown.
Right,
you know?
I can see. So that's the reason.
I wanted to be a big league. Huh?
That's the reason. I'm going to have to do another interview. Watching the clock, I really kept you on for a long time, and you have been great, Joe. Okay, so how would you like to be known in terms of your name?
I'd like to be known by Gonzalo Naranjo, but my nickname, which I wish to be called, or my, you know, my closest person calls me, is Charlie.
How do you spell Charlie?
To pronounce that correctly in English should be spelled C-H-O-L-L-Y.
Oh, like Charlie Dressen.
That's right.
Right.
In Spanish, it's spelled C-H-O-L-I.
So which one do you want?
Well, if you're going to use it in the United States,
yeah.
I suppose I'd use Charlie as
like Dressen.
Charlie Dressen.
Right.
Because the other Spanish name would be Charlie.
Right. How do you spell your last name, Naranjo?
N-A-R-A-N-J-O.
So that's like orange.
Orange tree.
Yeah, orange tree, Naranjo.
Orange tree. It's the meaning of the... In the translation, should be orange tree.
Mm-hmm.
Not the fruit.
Right. So you grew up in Cuba.
I'm born.
You were born in Cuba.
I'm born and raised in Cuba.
Right. When was that?
Well, I was born in 1933, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, in Havana.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah.
And
a long time ago.
Yeah.
Many moons.
Yeah. Well, I'm not that much younger than you.
How are you?
Yeah.
Which town are you located in? Tampa?
Me? I'm now in New Hampshire.
My wife
and I teach at Dartmouth College.
I see.
And, what was it like in your growing up years? I mean, was the country still crazy about baseball the way it is?
Well, it always has.
Yeah.
See, baseball, I think it was played even before it was instituted here in the United States.
Yeah.
And people carried out of, like, you know, like football in South America.
Right.
Something I like. It's just that same sort of a passion for the game.
Do you remember what kind of equipment you had in terms of a glove or a bat or a ball?
Well, I even have pictures of it. I brought all my memorabilia from Havana.
Mm-hmm.
And I have it here. Well, you can tell by those times. As a beginner, we used to play in the neighborhood corner. Which, in those times, the cigarette boxes used to be made of cartoon. I don't know, the board, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we used to break them in half, get a piece of paper, put a stone inside, and wrap it up in those cigarette package.
Mm-hmm.
And we play a hand, with a head.
Right.
And we race to the different four corners of the street, see? And we call it the bases.
Mm-hmm.
We hit it with the hand, you have to fill the ball, throw it first base, and make it out, like a baseball game. We used to play that at night, under the light of the pole, in the corner of the home. And then, that's where you begin as a kid. And then, if you're growing up, well, you start playing in soft pitch, you know, with the other guy or a bunch of guys. Then you start playing hardball in the sand lots. And in my case, I went to school, to a private school, a very famous private school down there, Catholic private school. Was one of the best three schools in the country.
And they had
they had a baseball team there, all organized by the fathers.
Uh-huh.
It was a Catholic school.
And
the brothers, let's say.
It was a good team.
It was one of the best teams in the town in baseball.
So you must have had a special uniform and good equipment.
We had the equipment, yeah. The brothers used to supply the spikes or the gloves, but everything else. And they had a beautiful field, which it had a farm not too far from the school. That in those times there were plenty of farms nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a beautiful field out there, very well taken care of, and we had a wonderful professor.
And what position did you play?
Well, I started as a shortstop, and then we had a really good shortstop in the school team when we grew older, higher classification in high school ball. So I played first base, and one of the brothers said, I want to see Gonzalo pitch. And when they saw me pitch, they say, we go to the championship with him as a pitcher. Since then, I've been pitching.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you made your mark as a pitcher?
As a pitcher, right.
Right.
That's it.
Uh-huh. And did you win the championship?
We didn't win the first year. As a matter of fact, I think we only won one game. I shot out somebody. I don't remember what school.
Mm-hmm.
And I lost a very tough game, and then I got a pretty good beat in some of the ball clubs here in the whole island. You know, we were a championship in the island, and I was. Oh, you did. And I was choice as the best high school player in Cuba in 1949-50.
Was Camilo Pascual or Pedro Ramos, were they contemporaries of yours?
He was temporary with me, but when he was a professional ball player, Pete...
He's older than you, right? Ramos?
Yeah. Pete came to the professional league when I already was there.
Mm-hmm.
And then in a couple of years, he became one of the best Cuban pitchers ever.
Right.
Then I pitched against him quite a few games down there. He played for different clubs.
Did you follow Major League Baseball when you were a kid growing up in Cuba?
All the knowledge I got.
How did you get the knowledge? On the radio?
All the advice that the big star used to print in the paper here in the United States used to go to Cuba and be translated there. It was put in the sports page.
Mm-hmm.
In those times, all I read was sports page and the funnies.
Right.
And so I got quite a bit of advice from guys like Dizzy Banks and Bucky Walters. I read about Roger Hornsby and Melvin Ott, Marty Marion, and then later on, Dan Musial, and, you know, Williams and DiMaggio, you know, was a big...
Right. Who was your favorite?
Well, DiMaggio was always... I always wanted to see him play. And Williams, and... I say DiMaggio was my favorite because... He's, you know, his fame. And his
right, like Ernest Hemingway and the Old Man of the Sea in Cuba, right?
Yeah, I saw the picture.
Yeah, and
I saw the picture. Right now.
And DiMaggio was his...
Actually, I don't live too far from where the film was made. And as a matter of fact, it's where I learned to swim, right where they filmed the picture.
Wow.
I learned to swim there with a guy that used to be the lifesaver there.
Huh.
We used to rent the house right close to where the house was filmed when I was a kid, because the doctors of those days used to advise the family to take the kid for 15 days to the beach every year in the summertime when school is school is out.
Yeah.
So we used to rent down there, and even though we used to always go with my aunt and my uncle that they're buried in Tampa, pull me out to the water. That's the way I learned how to swim.
How about Satchel Paige? He pitched in Cuba.
Yeah. My uncle caught him.
Oh, your uncle caught him?
My uncle played almost, I think, about 27 years in the United States. He used to sign ball player for Mr. Lawrence. Mr. Lawrence was a president of the bank in Portsmouth, Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And he used to go to Cuba to my home, and he signed very famous ball player down there, which my uncle was his, you know, he was very well known here in the United States in those times because he was one of the few Cuban ball players that used to play here in the States. As a matter of fact, I think he was one of the first one that played in the first black and white ball thing that played in 1933, but he only played one game.
Mm-hmm.
As I understood when I talked to Rodolfo Fernandez, he was one of the famous Cuban pitchers. He was a color guy. He lives in New York, and he was the one who told about my uncle only caught one game. He was a catcher.
As a kid then, and as a young man growing up, baseball was a real Cuban thing. I mean, it was part of Cuba.
Yeah, it was. They had all kind of pictures given away by politicians, you know, with the picture. was a famous ball player in Cuba.
You were there, though, during Batista's time, right?
Yeah.
Batista.
Both times.
Batista and Castro.
Yeah.
Yes, so that's one thing they must have agreed on, at least. If they agreed on nothing else, it was baseball.
That's right.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, they tried to buy the professional ball team in the Winter League in Havana. The politician, I mean, Batista tried. And the owners told him no, that they own the franchise and they don't want politics involved with them.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that because I was very close to the guy that owned the ball club, because since I was one of the few ones that could speak English and had some education,
mm-hmm.
Well, they figured they had me for several other things besides just playing ball.
Right, so how many, so when did you actually then make it to the major leagues, though?
Well, I made the Washington Senators in 1954.
But was Pasquale there then?
No.
Or Ramos?
No, the one who went up, the only one who went up that in 54 and made a spring training was Marrero, Connie Marrero.
Oh, Connie Marrero, yeah.
Who was already there.
Right.
Camilo Pasquale and I was the only one left when they broke camp in Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
And we went all the way north. So before we broke camp, Calvin Griffin called me to his room in the hotel, Angel B Hotel in Orlando. I don't know if you recall him or not. And he said,
yeah, next year there's gonna
he signed me to the big league contract.
How much?
It was a retroactive contract. If I stay with the ball club, I think I make the average salary. I mean the limit salary. And if I would have been out by May the 15th, I would have made $600. I only spent one day with the Senators, and that very same day they shipped me out to Chattanooga.
So you had one day in the Major League?
In the American League.
Oh, the American.
The first time I witnessed the game against Yankees and Washington that day, that Mickey Vernon hit a home run of Reynolds in the 10th inning, and they won the game 5-3, I think.
At Yankee Stadium or in Washington?
No, in Griffin Stadium.
In Griffin Stadium in Washington.
You know, in those times when Washington used to be the opening day, because the press used to go
throw out the first ball
pitch. And then the next day, everybody start playing.
Right. So that was the the 500-foot home run? The one
No, that was not the famous one. I think it was before.
Before.
I think it was in 53.
Right. So you didn't get into
it. Was it against Chuck Stubbs?
Chuck Stubbs, right.
Yeah.
You didn't get into the game, though.
No, I just watched the game from the bench, and I was assigned by Bucky Harris. Used to be the manager.
Right.
He told me after I threw body practice, I was changing my sweatshirt, you know how they do.
Right.
And he said, well, you are trying to sit with the president while the game is going on. You carry your glove and you guard him in case that they hit a line drive over there because his box is too close to the home plate. And they used to do that a lot with all the ball players before, too, as I understand.
Who was the president?
Eisenhower, Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Oh, Eisenhower. So, yeah. So you were guarding him from getting hit?
Well, no, he threw me out of the game.
Who?
The ball player, Eisenhower.
He threw you out?
And, yeah, it's what the ball players say, you know. Because what happened is when I was walking toward his box seat, he already had thrown the ball.
Right.
And, you know, the biggest scramble, like everybody tries to get the ball.
Right.
And he got the ball in his hand at that time when I was walking toward his box seat. It was a pretty good distance.
Yeah.
I'd say over 60 feet. So he waved at me like he wanted to throw the ball, see?
Yeah.
So he did. He threw the ball to me, and I was going to carry the ball back to him and say, no, throw the ball back. So we played catch. And that was a pretty big, you know, I guess everybody, all the newspaper and all that, started, you know, got a kick out of that. And then I finally went over his box seat, and there was Cassie Tanger and Bucky Harry, and they say, what do you want, for being here with the president? You want a picture or what, a baseball? I said, no, I want a baseball signed by him. So he signed a baseball for me, and I sat with him for a while when the game started. So he started interviewing me, you know. No, it wasn't an interview. He was talking to me like, you know, you're talking to a guy in the streets.
Yeah.
Just the same matter. You know, just like he knew me all. We knew each other all our life, you know. And he said, he asked me where I was born, what school I went to, and what my father did, and things like that, you know. And well, you can go back to the bench because he, you know, he had a glove that I think Mr. Griffin had gave him. So he said, I think I can take care of myself. So the ball player started kidding me. He said, hey, you got bench already.
You got what?
Got bench.
Oh, bench.
Huh. You don't last one inning.
What happened to the baseball that he signed?
I got it with me.
Oh, you still have it?
Yeah, I still have it. I have the picture.
Wow.
See ya.
But that was your only day with the Senators?
That was the only day.
It was some eventful day. Some incredible day.
I mean, I was surprised myself because when I went back into the clubhouse, all the newspaper that were gathered there was interviewing me, you know. And then later on, Bobby Bryan said you were queen for a day.
So this was in 1954.
Opening
day, right?
Opening day, 1954. I think it was Wednesday, the 19th or the 21st.
Right, so I should be able to get this out of the Washington Post archives.
Okay, I'm trying to get myself, Mr. Frommer.
Call me Harvey.
Marty.
Harvey.
Call me?
You call me Harvey, I'll call you Charlie.
Okay, Harvey.
If I can get it, I'll send it to you.
Wow.
Okay?
Listen. Do me this favor.
My son is a report.
It was a morning edition.
Morning edition.
In the Washington Post.
Okay.
From Bob Addis.
Okay, I know him.
Remember Bob Addis?
Yeah, sure.
In which he makes a resemblance of his ball player that was in the roster.
Right.
I was the morning before we went to the ballpark.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to have that, if it's possible. It was in the morning edition before the game.
Right, but was there an article about you and Eisenhower?
No, it's an article before the game, before everything happened.
Right.
And he had a resemblance of the personality of each one of us.
Right.
He's, you know,
but how come,
in his own way.
How come you didn't get anything in there about you and Eisenhower?
In 1955.
Right.
Because I pitched against Pittsburgh when they went to spring training in 53.
Right.
And I beat him down there. I was about 18 years old. I beat him 4-1. And Mr. Ricky saw me. And he liked it. So they got me a waiver for, I think, about $6,500, something like that at those times.
So, but when you had the one game with Washington, where did you go after that in 54?
Chattanooga. I went to Chattanooga.
And how did you do?
I didn't get much action there in Chattanooga, and I got an infection in my tonsil. So they shipped me out to Charlotte, and they find that out there because I had a sore arm. Something wrong with your tonsils.
Right.
He was right.
But
so
then,
I was operated on there in Charlotte, North Carolina, in some hospital. And I got my tonsils out, so again. So that spring training, I went to early camp that Fort Myer had with Mr. Ricky. And I did so well that I make the big team. But Mr. Ricky walked to me and